Commissioner Hogan, are you on the line? How are you this morning? Good. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Carlos Lopasta. Excellent. You're welcome. How are you this morning? Good morning. Sorry?
Hello.
Oh.
Hello.
Why don't we go ahead and get started? Good morning, members. Let's go ahead and take the roll.
Okay. Commissioner Bostick.
Here.
Commissioner Dallenberg. Commissioner Hogan. Commissioner Hogan? Well, I know he's been here. Commissioner Mathis? Commissioner McKee?
Here.
Commissioner Miller?
Here.
Commissioner Moore? Commissioner Riley? Commissioner Roussan? Commissioner Turbeville? And Chair LaCasa?
Here. Thank you, Madam Secretary. Today we have an interesting presentation, one that I regard as probably the most important we'll receive during the course of our work as the subcommittee of the commission.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Jay Moore. I just wanted to record my presence. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have a quorum.
We have a quorum. Excellent. We don't have any action items today, but it's always good to have a quorum. So today we're going to be hearing from the Office of Economic Development and Demographic Research. Amy Baker. She's going to tell us about, she's going to give us an in-depth analysis of the demographic trends in Florida over the next few decades. And these are issues that are going to be relevant to our 20-year planning horizon. And hopefully you'll find this as useful as I do. Please feel free during the course of the presentation to jump in since you're on the phone. To jump in at any time with questions. We'll have it as an open forum. You don't need to go through the chair. And I expect to have a very lively discussion with you, Amy, whenever you're ready.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today we'll be kind of extending the conversation that we actually began in May to focus on two particular topics. One is that the services that are being provided by state government, and the other is our revenue sources that support them. First, we're going to quickly look at a few of the highlights from the presentation that we had in May to kind of set the stage for the remainder of the discussion. And remember as we go through this that demographics is the study of the characteristics of the population, and obviously the count of the population is probably the most important one. The first thing to remind everyone of is the fact that the economy is inextricably tied to the population growth for Florida. Population growth continues to be the primary driver of economic growth, and it drives both employment and income growth for Florida. And that means that demographics is the key to understanding Florida's future economic health. The population...
I'm sorry, who is this?
That's Mike Hogan. I can't hear the speaker.
I apologize, Commissioner. She's getting the mic closer now.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Commissioner, is that better? Were you able to hear? No?
I can't hear.
Is the button pushed?
It's on.
It's on.
Turn it on high. My volume on high.
We're going to try another microphone.
How about this? Is this better?
I can hear it much better, yes.
Okay, we'll work on another microphone then. What we were talking about is just some of the highlights that we'd had in the last presentation and just kind of using those to set the stage for today. The first thing to remember is that the population growth in the recent past has been growing between 2 and 2.6%, which is extremely healthy, and it's been growing at that level since the mid-1990s. Over the forecast horizon that you all are dealing with, that growth is projected to slow, and that it would only be slightly above 1% by the time we reach 2030. So that's, even though that sounds like a dramatic drop and it sounds like very small growth, it in fact for Florida will continue to be very, very significant. That's equivalent to a city the size of Miami being added to the state every year. So that's still a lot of growth, even though it's a small percentage. That means we're still on track to break the 20 million mark sometime shortly after 2010, between 2010 and 2015. And that fact will make us surpass New York as the third most populous state in the country. In the next decade, almost half of the growth in the entire country will be coming from only three states, California, Texas, and Florida. The April 1st population, just to think of the numbers, right now we're slightly over 18 million. We're 18,349,132. And by the time we reach the end of the forecast period, 2030, we're going to be over 26.5 billion. So that's significant. That's a large number. The Florida's population growth, well, we've been driven in the past and will be driven in the future even more so by migration. Now, that's foreign and domestic, but that's right now running about 87% of our population growth. In the future, by the time we hit the 2020s and heading into 2030, all of our growth in the state of Florida will be coming from migration. And that has an implication for the rest of our discussion, which is the fact that we are going to have very few homegrown workers in Florida. They're mostly going to be coming from other states and in particular in the future from other countries. The net migration by county, just to look at it in terms of the spread throughout the state, particularly the central area of the state is very heavily driven by migration at this point in time. It's about 100% for 22 counties, the bulk of them in the central part of the state. And then surrounding that area, it ranges from how important migration is to them. And then the population by age group, the important thing to remember here is that we have a bubble in our population for those that are running between 40 and 60 years of age, particularly in the earlier years. And that bubble in the next 20 years is going to move into retirement age. And so that's going to be driving a big part of the rest of our discussion. The percent of population growth by age group, well, over half of our growth as we move forward into 2030 is going to be in the 60-plus range. And then on the other edge of it, we're still going to have growth at the younger ages, 0 to 17, but that growth is only going to be about 14% of our overall growth. But that sets up an interesting dilemma for us. And then finally, in that kind of series that we talked a little bit about before, when you look at, traditionally when we look at population percentages for a state or a country, we view it as a pyramid, that you have the biggest concentration in the younger ages, and then it tapers up until a point that's your older ages. And so the younger age cohorts actually support the smaller, older age cohort. Well, in Florida, and for the nation as a whole and for most of the world, that's not true any longer. Because of the baby boom population, we've actually had a bubble in the middle for the last couple years, and that bubble is going to be moving up to the top of the pyramid where we'll have larger concentrations of older people than in any of the areas down below it. So that kind of brings us into what we're talking about today, which is mainly driven by the baby boom cohort, and that's probably the most important force that we're dealing with.
The baby boom cohort actually began to be born in 1946 and ran for about 20 years to 1964. They began entering into the workforce, if you age them out, about 1967, and then the last of them entered the workforce about 1985. And that sets us up for where we are right now. In 2011, just 4 years from now, we're going to see the beginning of the baby boomers be actually in retirement. And that'll continue with the rest of the cohort through 2029. Given that they'll be in retirement anywhere from 20 to 30 years, given current projections, that means that we'll be done with the baby boomers sometime around 2050. That means the baby boom cohort's influence, which has been considerable, has lasted about 100 years by the time they finished. Now, what does that mean? Well, a couple of things. Looking globally, by 2025, we know that the world is going to be much older than it is right at this moment. And if you look at the U.S., at the other states, they'll look demographically much more like Florida looks today than they ever have. In addition, we're going to be far less Caucasian, much more culturally rich. We're going to be much more multicultural. And we're going to be far more concentrated in urban areas than we are at this point. The rural areas will have very, very small populations, and there won't be as much of that. The aging population that we've got is really a function of three things: the baby boom cohort, which we're focusing on, but also falling fertility rates. For the United States, that's not as much of an issue as it is for the rest of the world. When you look at states like Italy, Japan, and then even the European Union, their fertility rates aren't even at the replacement level. Right now, the United States is just right at that point, slightly below. So we're able to replenish our population and keep it steady without relying on migration, but just barely. Other countries aren't able to do that at this point. And then finally, rising longevity or life expectancy. We know that biologically, people can probably live somewhere between 130 and 150 years, but our technology, our medicines, our ability to sustain life that long is nowhere near that level. In the timing horizon that you're looking at, 100 years is probably a much more reasonable expectation of what the maximum longevity is. Now, the biggest implication for all of this and for the state of Florida is on national workforce trends. We know that the ratio of taxpaying workers to retirees is going to fall. Today in the United States, about four workers support every one retired person. 50 years from now, the United States is going to have only about three working people supporting every retired person. And in Florida, that statistic's going to be even less. It's going to be about 2 to 1. What that means for us is that the pool of native workers, those that are actually born in the United States, is definitely going to shrink. And that means that new retirees are not going to be fully replaced by younger workers unless something else intervenes. That's going to cause worker shortages for us, especially among the highly educated and the skilled, where it takes some time to develop the skills that they need to be in the jobs that they're going into. And that's going to be the norm as we move forward. It's going to increasingly get to that level and then stay at that level at least through 2050. There's some additional ramifications, though, that we have to think about, that once you have a labor force contraction, that's going to end up depressing economic output and boosting inflation. And the reason why is because you're going to have two kinds of shortages. You're going to have worker shortages. So to attract workers, you're going to have to pay more to get them, which boosts inflation. And to the extent that you're not able to fully replace your workforce with the same skills in the future, then you're going to have some shortages of actual goods and services. And that's going to drive up prices as well. The effect of those two things, the inflation and the contraction of the labor force, means that the gross national product, or what we call GNP, is going to drop about from 4.5%, which is normal in these times. We've had some higher years, but normal would be about 4.5%, to about 1.5% growth as we move into this. So that's very slow, very just, it's still positive growth, but it's just nothing to write home about. The another ramification of this is the fact that the longer long-term economic slowdown that we're going to be looking at and the larger retirement population that we have is going to further lead to decline in consumer spending and changes investment patterns as the senior population spends down its savings. And we're going to talk more about that in a minute because that has ramifications for our sales tax. And then in addition, finally, there's going to be a lower standard of living, especially for those living on fixed incomes in retirement for 20 or more years. Their standard of living may be as much as 10% less than the standard of living that we enjoy today. So it paints a picture of just much slower growth, much less economic activity, fewer purchases, and worker shortages. So bringing that home to Florida, what will we experience? Well, obviously, we are the grayest state in the nation at this point. So everything we've talked about for the nation is going to come much more intense for Florida, where our senior population is going to be about, 26.1% of the state's population in 2030. So over a quarter of our population will be aging. But we're going to have an additional challenge because we're not just graying in place like many states are, most of the states are. We're also still going to be growing. We're still going to have more people at every segment. So even though they're going to be growing more slowly, we're going to have a greater demand for services than we have today and also the need to pay for those services. We're also going to have a problem with allocating increasingly scarce natural resources, especially water in Florida, and then the provision of needed infrastructure. We know that new infrastructure is needed to meet the growing demand, but we also have a lot of replacement issues as some of the existing infrastructure ages. So we kind of bear that in your mind as we go forward over the next couple of slides, is that we've got the aging challenge everyone else does, but we have the additional challenge of growing, which only a handful of other states will face. California would probably be the greatest equivalent to us. So what are some strategies? I mean, if our biggest problem is going to be the workforce shortage, what are some things we can do or attempt to do to try to mitigate that? Well, the first one, the obvious one, is going to be attracting migration from countries which have greater youth populations and will become an important that whole effort would become an important relief valve for worker shortages. Now, we said that that globally we're going to be facing this problem, but there are a few countries that won't. Latin America will continue to have a more youthful population. Asia will be able to contribute youthful population to other countries. And those are probably the two biggest areas. India would be another one. Some of the African countries would be yet another one. Why do we want to do that? Well, not only does it boost our overall workforce, which we will have a need to do, but we also know from some studies the Federal Reserve and others have done that are more academic in nature, that on average, not necessarily everyone, but on average, immigrants are younger than the Native Americans. They're more inclined to work at any job that's available and have more children per family. All of those things are going to kind of offset the malaise we're going to be experiencing within our own demographic pool. So it's important to bring that in. That would have the effect of increasing our workforce and offsetting the baby boom population cohort drain. It would have the effect of increasing our fertility rates, which also has positive implications, and the fact that they're more inclined to work will be helpful too. At the other side of the coin, we probably can do a lot more things to incentivize people to keep workers in the workforce longer, and that's both on the supply and the demand side. We need to provide incentives to older folks to either remain in the workforce or to come back into the workforce. So that's the demand side, the supply side. But on the demand side, we probably need to do a lot more to encourage businesses to hire older folks and keep them on. And it may be making some allowances like having more flex time or shorter work weeks, things like that that would accommodate some of the needs of retired folks. So there's two different ways you can attack the reduction in workforce that we're going to be having. Now, moving specifically into Florida's budgeting and revenue picture, what are some of the implications for all of this? Well, first of all, we know that the state is going to have a need for more costly services with less revenue. And that's more and more costly, because more services, because we're still continuing to grow at all levels, and probably more costly because the fact that we're going to be continuing to gray as a state. And we know from quite a few studies that the services that government provides tend to be more costly, the more costly services are needed by elder folks. Then secondarily, we know that labor-intensive jobs are going to be the hardest to fill, and those are things like firefighters, police, construction. Assume that we're able to increase salaries, to increase attraction of folks coming from other states and countries into Florida to increase our work pool. And most importantly, that we're able to convince some older folks either remain in the workforce or come back into the workforce, we still are not going to be able to use at least that last group to do some of the labor-intensive jobs. I think somebody said something. Okay. And those would be, for state government, it's going to be our road builders or firefighters or policemen, those types of jobs. The things like education, maybe some areas of medicine, will be able to accomplish a lot in doing that. But those labor-intensive jobs will be tougher. And we know today's elderly prefer face-to-face interaction. The folks that exist today that are seniors like to be on the phone with someone. They like to go into an office and meet with someone. And in the future, as the existing baby boom cohort ages, they're bringing in more skills, more technologically advanced skills than some of the elders have today, at least as a group, not every one of them. And so that provides some opportunities. They're going to be more comfortable working over the Internet and working through instant messaging and emailing. And so instead of having so many physical locations as we have today, it may be that we can reduce some of that and have things like kiosks and internets and things like that. An example, you might know that one of the airline companies is shifting from having counter people to having kiosks with one person manning several kiosks to purchase your ticket or to pick up your ticket. And so they're able to take one person, have them do a lot more than just having straight-to-face interaction with a counter person. It may be, as a state, we can look at doing some of that and in the process produce some savings.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question? The bullet point, you have labor-intensive jobs, firefighters, police, construction, would be harder to fill. Would you say it's going to be harder to fill, or are we going to need more of them? I mean, as the state continues to grow, I would see that we would need more of the firefighters, the police, and more construction workers, more so than harder to fill. I think that because of the fact that as we need more of them, and we're still having the constraints on our budgets with less revenue, I think that's going to be, I feel that's going to be the problem more more so than harder to fill those positions. Am I off base here?
No, not at all. It's going to be both. I mean, it's definitely going to be, because we have a greater need, you're definitely going to need more of them at a time when you're drawing from a shrinking pool. So that's extremely important. But in addition, if you said Florida designs a strategy, or was able to design a strategy, some of it's beyond our control, that had three pieces to it, that had us drawing on migrants from other states, that had us paying higher salaries to attract people, and in addition, focused on older folks and bringing them and retaining them in the workforce, for the labor-intensive jobs, that third leg of attracting older folks to do these jobs longer is not as much available for the labor-intensive jobs. We know that skill-wise, they're going to be, you know, they have a lifetime of skills that we can draw on. So they're going to be more productive than somebody younger. So that's fine. We know that mentally and being, you know, in every other aspect able to do the job, they're going to be more productive than younger people. But older folks at one leg will have a harder time doing things where it's going to demand that be on the feet all the time or heavy exertion like those jobs are. The other thing that we can probably think about as an implication for services in addition to less reliance on physical space is that we're going to need fewer employees as the use of technology increases. You can use technology to increase the productivity of every employee that you have right at this moment. An example of this is some of the work of the United States Veterans Administration, where they're actually doing a dial-in system for healthcare now, where they give remote control devices to people that live in more remote or rural areas that allow them to check their own blood pressure, to do a number of other things, and then use the computer and the internet to transmit that information to someone who can monitor it and who's a professional. So that enables that person to stay at home, and it enables fewer people to actually service them. So we'll be able to see some more of that as we move forward. So some of the productivity we'll be able to do and increase will hopefully offset the need for services. The big service area that we need to think about moving forward is obviously healthcare. Now, our problems are not as severe as the federal government problems because they have Medicare in addition to Medicaid. So our problems tend to focus just on Medicaid recipients. And we know today that elderly and disabled Medicaid recipients account for about 23% of the caseload in terms of numbers, but almost 70% of Medicaid spending. So if we're moving into a future where we have more and more elderly swelling those ranks, our costs are going to skyrocket, and at least for acute and long-term care services. We know that based on what's happening today. The only thing that can offset that is if technology really outstrips where we think it's going to be heading at this point in time. The other thing that counts for us, or that we have to think about in terms of Medicaid, is not just the demand for overall services, but the fact that the majority of nursing home residents rely on Medicaid as kind of a last-gap support system. And that means after the cost of their care exhausts all their existing savings, then they fall back into the Medicaid system as they begin to qualify for service. So, and we know nursing home care is extremely expensive. Florida's taken a lot of efforts to move to home health care, which is less expensive, but the demand for those services is still going to dramatically increase. And then,
let me ask you a question. Do you want to entertain questions during the course of the conversation?
Sure.
Okay. Briefly, the healthcare issue, states like Oregon have experimented with rationing of healthcare in order to cut costs. Has EDR performed any kind of analysis of those rationing programs to see how they would fit in Florida over the coming decades?
To date, we've never been asked to do that. We're real aware of it. We've been following that for a number of years now, and it does. It has reduced costs for them. Florida just hasn't gone that direction yet with our Medicaid program. We tend to, at least in the areas where we provide services, fully provide those services.
What kind of acceptance or rejection has the Oregon program gotten from the public? It's been about 10, 15 years now.
Yeah. In their area of the world, it's very accepted. It's not nearly as controversial as it was when it first started happening. If you were to introduce it into a whole new region of the country like the South, I think you'd back up and start over. I think you would have to fight all those same battles again. It's, it probably from the early press they got when they instituted it, it probably wasn't as dramatic as the response to it became. But it just sounds, you know, so unusual for us to ration care and you know, talk about that. But as a state, Oregon has done a lot of things where there's voluntary participation in that rationing. So the culture there, I think, is just a little bit different than here.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of, you know, other costs that we'd be facing in the future, and this is kind of a good news, bad news, as technology increases, as new services are developed, as new procedures, new drugs are developed that all prolong life, we know that that creates the potential for more chronic problems as people live longer. So technology is expensive when it's introduced. Its cost tends to drop as it's deployed, which is a good thing. But what we have to bear in mind is people live longer. Some of those life-altering events like cancer and things like that may be addressed more effectively in the future. But chronic problems like heart disease and things like that are going to continue to exist. So we're going to have continuing costs of some kind for the elderly population, at least through our forecast window. And then finally, is another kind of element to this, is the fact that the number of family caregivers are going to diminish in the future. Right now, we've got a lot of, because of the cohorts being the baby boom being the primary caregivers at this point in time, it's so large that they're able to find caregivers to help assist or completely care for the elder folks and their family. As we move forward and the baby boomers become that group needing care, there's a smaller cohort behind them, so there's fewer people to take care of them. And as there's fewer people to take care of them and assist them, then there's probably going to be a need for at least a segment of that population to have state-sponsored health care and federal-sponsored health care. So that's kind of the dimensions of health care we're going to be looking at. The other area, and this one is kind of interesting for Florida, that is impacted by this demographic shift is criminal justice. All else being equal, we know that the propensity to commit crime diminishes over time. That is, a person ages, generally speaking, they have less propensity to commit crime. It's the younger folks that tend to do that. And that would lead you to believe that as the baby boomers move into retirement, that our criminal justice needs are going to diminish in Florida. But in fact, because we've tended to increase the classification of crime, we come in year after year and have more crimes and more penalties, that isn't necessarily true. It may be a wash in Florida before it's all said and done. And then because there's going to be increased crimes and acts of fraud against the elderly, it may be that we actually introduce even more laws to deal with that and actually increase the use of our criminal justice system. So that one's ambiguous for us. Many states will probably see some sort of reduction in costs in that area. We may just hang in place or become more expensive. And then the other thing to remember is, as we keep people in prison as they age, they have a lot more needs and expenditures that the state has to address. They've got all the health care issues and aging issues that someone not in prison has, but in this particular case, the cost is picked up by the state.
I have two questions. Have you gotten projections of what that population will be 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now?
We have done some looking at that, and we can provide those information to you.
And when you do estimates of population for the prison system or population depending on Medicaid, do you also cost that out in your analyses based on current costs?
We do it several ways. Your window is actually the longest window in state government. Mm-hmm. Our budgeting process tends to be a one-year process. And then we have a constitutional amendment in place now that requires a three-year plan, so that's extended that window. And then a lot of the REC estimates, the Revenue Estimating Conference estimates, are 10-year looks. And that's really the furthest out we go in state government. So your window for the Taxation Budget Reform Committee Commission is actually the longest window that's out there.
Given what you just said, Amy, what and what you know about the demographic trends in Florida based on your agency's research, I think it's an appropriate time to ask you, what do you believe this commission should focus on, given all the other players looking at shorter planning windows? What should we be focused on, given this information?
This demographic shift, the aging of the baby boomers into retirement is the key driver in the future, and that's outside of our windows. It's our three-year plan, the one that we're developing right now, goes through from next year, 08, 09, through 2010, 11. So we're cutting off right as the retirement shift begins. Mm-hmm. And so, and even so, it's going to be smaller and grow over time. The number of baby boomers moving into retirement will be a small cohort at first and then growing as we move out into 2030. So you all looking at that and you all addressing that, what this demographic shift is going to mean for services and for our revenues is really the story for the future. Yeah.
Should we also be looking at ways of influencing those demographic shifts over time?
Yes. I mean, I think to the extent that it has spillover on our revenue streams and spillover on our budget, to the extent that you influence it and mitigate it or offset it, that would be where we'd want to go.
I hope you've got some discussion points on that particular subject.
Yeah, we'll address that a little bit, because that's definitely, that'll be the story for the nation and for the state for the next 25 years. And then moving on to education, this is also kind of a mixed story. For many states, they're going to actually see declining populations for the public school age population, 0 to 17. But for Florida, we are not going to be so lucky. As we mentioned earlier, our school age population is going to continue to grow. And because it's going to continue to grow, we're going to have to pay more and more for those services. So we're not going to get any break from the fact that some states have a declining school age population, because that's just not going to be a luxury we have. And we kind of share that burden mostly with California. And then the other service I would mention before I go into the next slide, those are the big three that you typically think about as being major cost drivers: health care, criminal justice, and education. And certainly they're all affected by demographics. The other one that's probably less intuitive but follows on the heels of those is transportation. We know as the baby boomers head into retirement that it's going to be harder for them to get around. Some of them will end up not driving or choosing not to drive at different points in time. And so they do have a need for transportation that's readily available to them and easy to use. And that's going to be another sort of service need that we know that will come with this demographic shift. Kind of changing track a little bit, the other big thing that's going to be happening in Florida and the nation at whole, but with a particular ramification on Florida, is that we're going to become more multicultural. And in Florida, what that means is going to be an increase in the Hispanic population. By the time we get to 2030, the Hispanic population is going to be about 25% of the state's population. Today, it's about 19.6%. So that's pretty healthy growth over that period of time. And that's going to have another ramification for us, which is we're going to have more and more folks that don't necessarily speak English either as their first language or don't speak it fluently at all through their lives. We know that about 1 million folks today, based on census results, have some difficulty in speaking English. Either they don't speak it well or they don't speak it at all. And so that kind of statistic would be translated into the future. So we know we need to make some accommodations as a state to deal with the fact that a quarter of our population in the future are going to be bilingual. They're not going to be just one speak English and that's it. So that's kind of a challenge for us to address as well. That's a good thing, though. I mean, remember we talked about migration, whether it's from other states or from other countries, being important as a source for driving up our workforce. We want this to happen. We should welcome this happening because that's the Hispanic population, generally speaking, follows all those characteristics we were talking about earlier, that they're younger when they migrate to this country, that they tend to have higher fertility rates than American-born folks, and that they're more willing to take any job that's available and work at it. So this is a positive thing moving forward for Florida. And now kind of transitioning into revenues, there's one other fact we probably need to bear in mind, which is when you compare the growth of Florida's revenues with the growth of our expenditures, there is sort of a mismatch. If you look over the longer period, if you look back over 25 years, roughly speaking, the growth of our revenues tracked the growth of our expenditures. But the more you narrow that window, when you start looking at the last 15 years, you start looking at the last 10 years, the last 5 years, we see that gulf expanding between the two. And revenues, even though they grow at a very healthy pace, are not growing as fast as our expenditures are, especially in the recent past. So that's going to be a challenge that exists today. And as we'll see in a moment, that's going to be a challenge that actually grows as the baby boomers begin to retire. So looking at revenues and kind of thinking first about the working age population, one implication of the declining working age population is that the government tax structure, which any government tax structure, which relies heavily on that age group, is going to have to be reevaluated. We know that the cohort that's going to contain our working age population in the future is going to be smaller, relatively speaking, to the size of the baby boomer cohort. So that means that group that's behind the baby boomers are going to be the ones that not only have to provide the services physically, they're going to be in the jobs supporting the baby boomers, but they're also going to be the ones where we get the largest amount of taxes from to support the baby boomer services provided by government. So that's one implication of all this that we need to think about. There's this natural pressure that's built into any tax system that relies on that group, and we're going to have part of that too. An increasingly smaller percentage of individuals are going to assume the bulk of the tax burden. That's what we're saying. As the number of elderly increases and the demand for services grow, it's going to be a smaller group facing that. And the states, obviously, they're going to be hardest hit are those that rely on personal income and payroll taxes as their largest revenue sources. So those states that rely on personal income taxes are going to have a big challenge ahead of them because the group where you get the largest amount of personal income taxes from is going to be smaller than it was, relatively speaking. So they're going to have a difficult time generating what they need to support the whole service array. So, you know, that is not to say that, a state like Florida shouldn't ever consider a personal income tax. I mean, that's another issue. But you certainly wouldn't want to replace the sales tax with it. The sales tax is going to position Florida better to weather this demographic shift than any personal income tax or anything like that would do. And then talking some more about the sales tax itself, we know from many, many studies that have been performed that the elderly tend to spend less than younger person on goods and more on services. So that means that the current state sales tax structure, with its dependence on the sale of goods, is going to come under increasing pressure because we focus on items rather than services, as we've got more and more of our population, ultimately a quarter of our population, that spend more on services as a way of life. We're going to have some inherent challenges from that. And if that risk is not addressed, if we kept everything in place like we are right now and just kept moving forward, then what you're going to see is much lower growth rates for sales tax receipts in the future than has normally been seen in the past. And given that sales tax is 75% of general revenue, and that is our what we fund the budget with largely, then that's a problem for us. And we know this phenomenon is not unique to the baby boomer population aging into retirement. Overall, services make up about 60% of personal expenditures. So that's inherent in the system. It's going to be made worse.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I mean, you might not want to answer this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Seeing what you just said in revenues at the state, states that will be hit the hardest are those that rely on personal income and payroll taxes. And that's states like Florida that rely mostly on sales tax collection for the general revenues of the budgets. And knowing that with the older population, which I'm a part of, we'll be hitting that number where we'll be spending less money and less sales tax collected, would it be your recommendation that this state, whether it's through this committee or through the legislature, look at the sales tax collection structure that we presently have now and maybe looking at how we can revamp that collection structure at this particular point in time? Should we start doing that now?
I think that would be my recommendation. We know that the sales tax structure, as you said, is the best one, you know, for us to rely on in terms of moving forward. Its configuration right now might not be ideal. There may be many different things we can do that could better position it. I mean, what you're looking for is broad base. You're looking for a very stable revenue source. You're looking for something that's not idiosyncratic, that's very, you know, uniform, straightforward, fair, equitable, all those kinds of things. So there probably is several different directions we could go to try to make sales tax a better source.
Let me be more to the point. Would you recommend that either through this commission or through the legislature that we look at our sales tax exemptions that we presently have in place to determine if some of those sales tax exemptions have weathered their time?
I think that's a fair strategy.
Yeah. Following up on that, Amy, do you think that sales tax exemptions in Florida should be periodically sunset reviewed?
You know, I think there's several ways you could tackle that. That is certainly one that's been on the table. It's the subject of a constitutional petition initiative. And I think that's one way of doing it. You could try to do it wholesale at one time. It's not going to be easy because there's, you know, each of these things come with their downside too. I mean, it's easy to say, okay, let's look at all the exemptions and get rid of them, bring them back. Obviously, the poster child in that review would be groceries. I mean, there's nobody that would want to extend the sales tax to groceries. Very few people, because it makes the sales tax more regressive. So at the big level, the higher level, yes, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to review exemptions. We want to make sure they still make sense, that they're the ones we want, that, you know, that there's not some things that we can reverse and possibly stabilize the sales tax and shore it up as we move forward. But the individual, you know, the devil's in the detail, the individual ones that you pick to do that with would be a big challenge. Now, whether you do that periodically, all at once, you know, how you do that is probably a policy question as much as anything else.
To what extent do we tax production in Florida at every level of production, raw material processing, finished products? Has EDR done any kind of research on that?
You know, when we did the sales tax on services, that was a really big issue, a big concern when we were doing that. It was called pyramiding, where, you know, you were taxing things that potentially could tax things in multiple places. And there was a study done at that point in time that we still have that looked at some of those issues, and we could provide a copy.
What were the conclusions? Were any conclusions reached?
It was actually done by Walter Hellerstein, who's a kind of a well-known tax attorney, a tax expert, and he didn't. His was more just providing guidance to the legislature at that point in time on watch for this, don't, you know, be careful about doing it this way. So it was more guidance than it was conclusions.
I have another question. Have you all taken a look at the taxation of internet sales in the state of Florida?
Not real recently. The federal government keeps acting to preempt some areas, and then which have to do with the internet service itself, not necessarily goods sold over the internet. And we've looked at that because we've had to cost that out. And then we have spent some time talking about and addressing some issues more in the abstract with, and I think Alan Johansson might have mentioned it in one of his presentations to the full committee, with some of the current efforts that are underway to allow states to tax internet sales, those sales of goods over the internet.
Aren't there states now that tax internet sales?
There's states that do varying attempts at that, and really probably the best known effort is a national effort to bring multiple states together to use their joint power to be able to do things like that. That streamlining initiative, I think Alan might have talked about that a little bit. It's kind of wrapped up into that issue. So that's, you know, as a nation, that's definitely something that needs to be explored going forward. But, for the state of Florida, it's real hard for an individual state to do that in isolation. You kind of need the power of multiple states to help pull that off effectively. We do, there are a lot of companies. I don't want to leave people with the impression that today you can buy something over the internet and it's not taxed, because there are a lot of companies that work with the Department of Revenue in Florida that voluntarily collect sales tax for sales, that sell, through catalogs, sell over the internet. And so I know the Department of Revenue has made a lot of efforts in that area over the last 20 years.
Also, I'm told, Commissioner, that the F&T committee is focusing on the issue as well. Going back a minute to the concept of value-added taxation, should this commission consider a system of VAT in for all levels of production through retail sales as a stable, would it be a stable source of income for the state to meet these service demands? What would the positive and negative impact of a VAT system be?
I mean, in large part, that's, again, probably a policy issue rather than one I can provide you a straightforward economic answer. You know, again, there's trade-offs in all these things. There's people relative to where we are right now. There would be people assisted by it, helped by it, and there'd be others that would feel harmed in some sort of conversion to another tax source. And so ultimately, it's not a straightforward economic, yes, this is definitely the direction you should go, or no, it isn't. I mean, we know that we have in place a sales tax. We know where it's going to feel pressure as we move forward into a different demographic makeup than we have today. That's all pretty straightforward. What you do to shore it up, or what direction you move in to replace it, there's not a lot of empirical things we can give you on that. We can tell you strengths or weaknesses, but for Florida as a replacement for the current structure of sales tax, I don't think we could tell you.
Do other states have a VAT?
There's states that are closer to it. I think I would want to do some more research and get back with you before I definitively gave you an answer.
Final question before, and I'll let you continue. When I asked the question on value-added taxation, I do it knowing that it has an impact on the state's competitiveness vis-a-vis other states and possibly other foreign jurisdictions. Could you address at some point during your presentation what Florida can be doing to remain competitive vis-a-vis other states, to attract businesses, to attract the workforce?
Okay. Yep, we can talk about that a little bit. The last thing, and kind of getting to the end of this, I want to talk a little bit about property taxes, just because the literature addresses the subject some, too. And again, this is in the context of the baby boom population aging into retirement. We know that if, you know, there's many groups of people, many people that have concerns with the property tax system, as, you know, we've been witnessing over the last couple of years. But traditionally, through polling and studies, we know that senior citizens typically have opposed property taxation to a greater extent than the rest of the population. And that's partially because so many of them lived on fixed incomes. But it's also because property taxes are typically used to support education, and their connection to a school-age population diminishes as they age. They don't have children of their own, or they're not expecting to have children of their own, so their connection to the need to use property taxes for schools becomes attenuated a little bit. So as that connection diminishes, then they're more apt to oppose property taxes and property tax increases of any kind as they move forward. So we know, even though right now we are kind of in the middle of a backlash, for lack of a better word, against a property tax system, there is reason to believe that in the macro sense that's going to increase over time rather than diminish. And then the other thing to remember about the property tax system coming under threat is the other side of it. Florida, like many states, does provide some income-based exemptions that advantage seniors to the exclusion of other folks. And so we need to remember, as the baby boom population is moving from pre-retirement into retirement, that more of them will become eligible for those tax preferences over time. So the cost of those preferences is probably going to exponentially increase. We know from a lot of the work that's been done that, as a group, the baby boom population is probably more affluent than the generations that preceded it. They've had higher earning potential over their lifetimes, more and better kinds of investment opportunities. And for a variety of reasons like that, they're, as a group, better prepared to enter retirement than their parents were or their grandparents were. But on the other side of that, we also know that about a third of the baby boom population, of that cohort, does not have the wherewithal to support themselves through an extended period of retirement, because that's the other thing they're going to be facing, is not 5 years or 10 years of retirement, but 20 years or 30 years of retirement. So having assets built up that you can use to supplement Social Security or your pension or whatever else to help you last that long is a difficult chore. And so we know about a third of the cohort won't have those assets in place to be able to do that. Those are the ones that are most likely to be able to take advantage of some of these breaks. So it's going to be a big population. A lot of our senior preferences tend to be income-based. So that's why we know there's going to be increasing pressure there. And so probably those are, I mean, there are implication on our other tax sources, but the sales tax and the property tax are such the big ones for Florida, the ones we most rely on as a state and local governments, that the other ones kind of pale in comparison in terms of the impacts on them. So those are the two I chose to talk about. I think the takeaway on the revenue side is that we need to be broad-based, stable, in terms of having something that will grow and continues to grow. And so kind of worrying about these threats, doing things to offset them is a good thing to do. And that was kind of the end of the formal comments I had to make.
Members that are attending by phone, do you have any questions at this time?
Oh, I'm fine. It's a little odd doing this way.
Thank
you.
I have a few of my own, and please feel free to jump in. You don't need to go through the chair. It's a small group, so we're doing this as an informal meeting. I want to pick up on your last statement, that we need to be broad-based, stable, and have tax sources that will continue to grow. Does EDR believe that the state's reliance on sales taxes as they are, with or without the exemptions that we have now, and the property tax structure that we have now, given the modifications that may come in the next 12 months, whatever they may be, do you think those two sources should continue to be the primary sources of revenue, given your criteria of broad-based, stable, and tending to grow?
I personally, because that's all I can speak to on this, I do believe that we are well positioned with the sales tax. I mean, there's things we can do to make it better, but in terms of a source, sales tax versus personal income, I do believe moving forward over time that the sales tax positions us better than many other revenue sources. So that one I feel very comfortable giving you an unambiguous answer on. Property taxes are a little bit more difficult. You know, ignoring people who pay property taxes. From an economic perspective, property taxes are considered one of the better taxes because it's viewed to be more like a user-based tax than other kinds of taxes are. You have a choice whether to buy property or not. If you buy a more expensive property, you're paying more in property taxes. If you buy a cheaper property tax, you're buying less. It's very efficient because it is very easy to identify who owns property, to develop a bill for them, to know whether or not they paid their taxes. You know, all of those things add into the economic definition of efficiency. So short of user taxes, I mean, if economists as a group believe user taxes are the best kind of taxes of all, because that's so tied to somebody's use of a particular item, and we think that's good, generally speaking. Economists overall would say property taxes are right behind user taxes. They're good. But the circumstances in Florida with the housing boom, the run-up, what people have experienced, the implications of Saver Homes on other segments of the taxpaying public, and things like that give you a totally different picture. Then you start worrying about, well, is our property tax system as it was before any of the changes the legislature made, the proposed constitutional amendment, whatever you all do as a group, it had issues that probably need to be addressed. So I can tell you economists think property taxes in general as a concept are good. But in Florida, clearly we had issues that, you know, needed to be addressed, had started being addressed. So the implementation was probably the one big area of concern here.
To what extent can property taxes or property tax structure influence the demographic trends that you've projected for us today?
If a state has relatively high, any state, has relatively high property taxes compared to all other states or compared to its immediate neighbors, then it can be a disincentive for someone to move into the state. Any higher tax that the state has relative to its neighbors can be a disincentive for somebody to move in. I mean, a classic would be personal income. If you had a personal income tax, that would be a clear disincentive for somebody to migrate into that state. And if we get if we provide disincentives for migration, whether it's, you know, wherever it's coming from, then we're going to dampen our workforce growth, and that's what we don't want to do right now.
Would that same disincentive, I would imagine that disincentive would apply both to working age entrance into the state as well as persons who want to retire here. But by the same token, couldn't a properly developed tax structure disincentivize the immigration of persons who would retire here that would demand more services than they could contribute in taxes? Could that be a check on that kind of immigration?
Speaking about property taxes in particular, in theory, yes, it would be hard to design that. Not that it couldn't be done, but it would be a challenge to design it because there are, in their existing constitution, and then within the U.S. Constitution, there are some requirements that we have a uniform and fair.
Let me rephrase the question.
Okay.
If we were to cap, for example, we were to keep Save Our Homes, if the voters decided they wanted to keep Save Our Homes and go beyond that to taxing the rate of growth of property taxes in general, commercial and residential, homestead, non-homestead, would that create an incentive? Would that create an incentive for the segment of the population that can least afford to pay for services on their own without government subsidy? Would that create an incentive for them to settle here, or have a neutral effect? Or create a disincentive?
If we were to create something like a variant of Save Our Homes for everyone,
right,
for the whole.
What impact do you think would be?
Well, property taxes are unique, among taxes. They are a zero-sum game. So anytime you provide a break for any portion of that population, and view a break as being, it can also be the opposite, that if you provide a disincentive for a lack of a break for one area, that's the same thing as providing a break for everyone else. Because it's a zero-sum game, you don't have clear winners with no one losing. So someone's going to lose always. So if we extended Save Our Homes, a variant of that, Save Our Business or whatever, to everybody else in the property tax system, it would have a lot of positive effects from one standpoint, which is you would be making the system less unfair and less inequitable. You'd be smoothing that out. But because you're doing that, it would have the effect of diminishing the Save Our Homes benefit. You'd be, even though technically it's on the board, it's still there, its value would diminish because everybody else is getting more of a break. So it's got to balance out somewhere. It's just one pool of money, and how you raise that, it's got to be split somewhere among the different people who pay. Does that make sense?
I think what you're suggesting is that horizontal inequity that exists between long-term homesteaders and new entrants into the homesteaded market, that inequity would shrink over time with this kind of a policy, which is, it's a personal goal of mine to achieve that. And I know it's going to take 20 years to get there. You can't do it overnight. But what I'm trying to look for here from a 20-year perspective is how can we incentivize through property tax policy the immigration of workforce age persons, check the immigration of persons who will come into the state and rely heavily on our services, and have an equitable property tax system doing that function.
And that's definitely the challenge. I think you can achieve parts of it more easily than all of it together. The part you can, right now, Save Our Homes, its benefit grows over time, as designed today. Its benefit grows over time. So the longer you're in your home, the bigger benefit you get. So that means that someone looking to move in the state has to have a really long time horizon for that to be a particular incentive to attract them into the state. So if you if you designed, if you could just in the abstract kind of rub everything out, if you wanted to make sure you were attracting workers into the state and new entrants into the state, you'd want a system that probably treated everybody the same from day one. You know, not that they have to wait for their benefit to grow over time, but they get that benefit from day one.
One second. I guess whoever wants to come back in will have to call back in, right? Okay.
When you do that, though, then you're attracting the whole group in. You're attracting the workers in, and you're attracting in somebody who just wants to retire here. Whether the U.S. Constitution and the Florida Constitution provisions would ever let you separate those two groups, it would be a real challenge. And off the top of my head, I can't think of an easy way to do that.
Well, a super exemption up front would help, wouldn't it?
It would help anybody coming into the state, it would help them all.
So coupling a super exemption concept with a save our homes concept for the long term would, in your mind, do you think the demographics we need to attract to the state long term would find that a property tax structure they could work with?
Yeah, I think it's one they could work with. I don't know that you would be culling out the group that's more costly in that process.
Right.
The only way I know to do that is more direct things. I mean, if you had higher salaries for workers, you obviously attract them in.
Those are beyond the scope of...
And they're beyond... That's an economic phenomenon.
Right. You know, that you raise a great point there. To what extent can we piggyback... To what extent can we contribute to macroeconomic shifts that we would desire through property tax structure, through growth management practices, and so forth?
In theory, economists have always said that you only have macroeconomic forces at the national level, that no state is big enough to influence those forces. But I think there is a growing school of people who believe that's not true, that when you have a state like Florida, you know, third largest state in the country, or California, if we sneeze, it's going to affect everybody else. And we know Louisiana, even with Hurricane Katrina, even though Louisiana is not a big state, it's not a powerhouse state, that had a big effect on the price of materials for construction and everything else. So I think that school of thought is dying. So I believe there are some things we can do to better position ourselves as a state relative to other states. And those are kind of macroeconomic influences.
And property tax is one of them.
I think that's part of the incentive package. I think that's part of you can definitely make it so onerous that you make people not want to come to Florida. You know, going the other way, can you make it so attractive that you can gain people in Florida? That force may not be as strong, but it's there.
I don't want to hog the microphone, commissioners, if anybody else has questions they want to jump in on. Let me just review real quick and might be able to wrap this up. Do you believe that, does EDR have an opinion or a concern, or is it starting to develop a concern that there is a peak level of population growth for the state?
As EDR, we've never been asked to pinpoint one, and I don't worry about that so much. I mean, I of all the things I personally worry about, I think you want to make sure that you have, as we talked about earlier, the infrastructure and services in place to meet the demand that's going to be there, you know, and be aware of the demographic shift, because that's going to be a huge change for us. But in terms of if we get this big, this is a critical breaking point, and I never really personally thought about that as the issue. The issue is more, can we meet those demands when they appear, to me.
I think I have like one other question regarding federal policy, particularly in Social Security and Medicare spending, which we all know is you know in trouble and needs work at the federal level. But I've always had the sense that when an elderly person, even one with few personal resources, moves into the state, they bring with them Social Security revenue and Medicare revenues, particularly for the economy in which they live, the city or town in which they live. How beneficial is that to the local economy, those benefits that come with that, that person? Is it a small benefit? Is it meaningless? Is it a zero-sum game?
It is a benefit. I mean, we say population is the driver for the state, and we don't say some population growth is the driver. We say all population growth. So we view typically any population growth from wherever it comes as being overall beneficial to the state. And, you know, there's probably some self-selection that goes on. The poorest of the poor, the most disadvantaged, probably don't even have the wherewithal to move to Florida. I mean, they're gonna age in place wherever they are. So there's some self-selection, but if it's someone with the wherewithal to move to Florida, they're probably a little bit better off to begin with. They're not the poorest of the poor, the most disadvantaged. But we tend to view it as an overall positive. I mean, as a class, it's certainly positive. When you break it up to, well, one-third of them are going to not have the wherewithal to go through 30 years of retirement, yeah, it raises some other questions.
Well, maybe mine's different from his. I'm looking at your population projections here. In 3 years, we had about 2.5 million people move into the state, according to your numbers. But then in 24 years, you're saying 6 million are going to move in to the state of Florida. And you're saying that it's going to go to like 1.1%, averaging 1.1% between 2025-2030. Have you all thought about that even with those numbers and Florida's projected growth, that some of the states, being in the Midwest particularly, probably some on the East, that when we get these numbers of people moving into the state, that some of the companies that are major companies in those areas would perceive that they better move to Florida because to continue to have the workforce, Florida will have the workforce, and therefore the numbers that you have between 2006 and 2030 might be a little bit off base?
You know, I think you raise an excellent point. And no, there's nothing built into that that specifically addresses that issue. But your point is excellent because all of these things are interactive. If you're doing well, you know, they're gonna escalate. They're going to feed in and escalate each other. If you're able to attract the workforce you need to support the population you have, then that's going to probably because you're paying them higher salaries. That's going to increase the standard of living for the whole state. And once you do that, then you start attracting other companies. So all of these things are interactive.
Well, I'm thinking about you saying that Florida. Even though we have the workforce, and that workforce might be those that have migrated to the state from other countries, and you think about companies in the Midwest, specifically Minneapolis area, that they have some major companies there. If those states and other states that population starts to dwindle, and they don't have the workforce, start looking at Florida as well. Maybe it's a place to relocate. These numbers, I think, to me, might be a little bit off, and I'm just projecting outwardly that these things might happen. I don't know if they will or not. You are the experts here, but I'm just running through my mind. Then what?
Yeah. I mean, I think our approach to modeling demographics is more of a steady state. I mean, we kind of say, okay, just normal, nothing no outlier activity on either side. But the scenario that you're mentioning definitely could happen. And it would influence these, push these numbers back up a little bit. We haven't taken that into account. The other side would be, you know, we don't pay the salaries, we're not able to attract the workforce, people don't want to move here. That's less likely. That's a lower risk, I think, than the fact that there may be, by 2030, these may be too modest, which is the point you're raising.
That's my sense of it, too. You know, if we had a Cat 5 hurricane every year for 6-7 straight years, that number would dip because the long-term expectations of someone considering to move to Florida would be affected. You know, they would know their costs would go up. The concept of actuarially sound rates would gain even more momentum in insurance policy in Florida rather than affordable rates and so forth. I can't help thinking that we have a lot more work to do with EDR in order to develop what I regard from a planning perspective two important refinements to the existing taxation system, both the property tax system and the sales tax system. All the testimony I've heard, and commissioners, I really hope you chime in on this one, all the testimony I've heard in all the committees I've participated in suggests the following. First, that the budget and tax processes of the state legislature and the state, the executive office of the governor, that whole process works and doesn't really need too much further refinement. Where the refinements need to occur is in the review of existing sales tax exemptions, possibly a review of how we tax business in Florida, but I don't seem to, I'm not getting as much noise on that subject as I am on the exemption issue, and certainly a lot of noise on the property taxation system in Florida, how we treat, how we address spikes in valuations that are market distortions, and that based on these population figures will probably continue to occur. Am I missing anything?
No, I mean, I think that's at least from a demographic perspective, which is what we're talking about, I think
right.
That's a fair way to look at it. I think we've got the base that we need to move forward. Now, what can we do to improve it? How can we make it stronger and more resilient? So I think that would be a fair takeaway from the demographic view of it.
Okay. Anybody else, commissioners? I'm going to give you the last word on this.
Well, I appreciate very much the opportunity to talk about this. But, as I mentioned, the other processes in Florida don't allow you to have this kind of longer-term view, including our three-year plan, which is just on the edge now of breaking into kind of taking these factors into account. So I think you guys have a tremendous opportunity and a large challenge to try to deal with a changing demographic shift in the midst of everything else that you're reviewing. But I do believe this will be the driver of our future.
Ms. Baker, I want to thank you so much for coming and addressing us today, and I know that we're going to need to rely on you heavily as we go forward, but thank you very much. Members, I don't know how many of you have left on the phone. Is there anybody left on the phone?
Hogan's still here.
Hogan, I can always rely on you. Excellent.
Still here.
Wow.
Jade Moore's still here.
Wow. I didn't. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Are there any we have the advantage of being in a publicly scheduled meeting? Are there any subjects that you would like to discuss more fully based on this presentation? Are there any ideas you'd like to put on the table that you and your colleagues could discuss right now in public? Are there any subjects that you would like us to address in the future? Now is a good time to have that. Should we stay on the course that we're on, which I think we've refined substantially today, to continue to review sales tax exemptions sales tax policy in general and property tax policy in general. Can I get a reaction on that one?
I think you are. I mean, I think that that's if what I just heard.
I agree. I think the summary you provided before as to where we currently are was right on point, and I think those two major categories of the sales tax exemptions and property taxes in general are essential, and not from the point of with property taxes further exemptions, but looking at taxable values versus what you referred to as market distortions.
Okay.
Well, I totally agree. I mean, I know that the Finance and Tax Committee are going to be looking at.
Chairman, do you think we're covering?
They don't must know hear me or something.
Commissioner Hogan, Commissioner Miller was in the middle of a question. I'll get to you right after he finishes.
I'm sorry,
but that is not a question. I just think that we're on the right path. I think the presentation that Ms. Baker gave us this morning, I think, is an excellent presentation. It kind of lays the groundwork of where we need to be going, what we need to look at. And I think that the sales tax exemptions is one of the areas that not only will we be looking at, but more in depth, the Finance and Tax Committee will be looking at. And she's already told us, I mean, this is something that's going to have to come into play for our general revenue and for the budget in the state of Florida. We can't continue to basically just look at where we are now and saying we lay dormant and hopefully be able to take care of the massive number of people that come into the state, a population that continues to get older, as we grow, that we're going to have some real serious issues that we're going to have to look at starting now. And somewhere along the line, we got to pay for these things. And we're not going to look at employment taxes. We're going to have to look at our sales taxes and the sales tax exemptions and looking at the big picture. I think it's something we need to look at. And I think we're going to have to look at it not only one time, but just like you said, I think we're going to have to start looking at it at a period of times, sales taxes and sunset of those sales taxes. I think that's going to have to be something that's probably established as we move on. So I think we're on the right path.
I'm very happy to hear that, Commissioner. Commissioner Hogan. Well, as I had stated earlier, I'm, you know, we've spent, in at least one other meeting, and today we've gotten testimony from persons that have presented that are intimately familiar with the state budgeting process, work with it professionally, and feel that there really isn't any substantial adjustment that needs to be made. The serious adjustments were made by the last commission, and by the legislature over time. However, obviously, if you have any suggestions you want to make, you know, that's what we're here for. It's an ongoing process. We can introduce new ideas at any time until we adjourn in May. But I personally, having chaired appropriations, having spoken to persons working in the process currently and in the past, I'm not getting any kind of pressure to revisit the way we currently do budgeting at the state level. So for me, and other commissioners have already said this, for me the issue is the adequacy and desirability of our tax structure to influence demographic trending over the next 20 years. And you know, I every time I think about our work, I think about Commissioner Barnett's and Commissioner and Chairman Benz's remarks many months ago about how important it is that our work be at the constitutional, you know, being constitutional, that is, at the 20,000-foot level rather than at the 10,000 or 5,000 or ground level, which is the one-year planning horizon, the three-year planning horizon, and even the 10-year planning horizon. So I'm always mindful of those things. Having said that, and to address your point directly, Commissioner Hogan, I'm not seeing any pressure to address the state budgeting process at this time. If I'm wrong, I hope someone enlightens me. Members, is there anything else for the good of the order for today?
Are we planning any further meetings?
We have a meeting scheduled, I believe, October 11th in Fort Lauderdale. And we're going to be hearing from the superintendent of schools for Broward County, who's asked to be heard to address education issues. And I invite superintendents and school board leaders from around the state to attend that meeting, and we'll open up the meeting to them as well in this kind of open forum, open discussion.
No comment.
Two other meetings that you have available as well.
And we have other meetings available as well, but I'm not contemplating at this time any other meetings in September. We have a slot for September 20th. I'd be happy to schedule any kind of testimony or even discussion without testimony for any commissioner if you desire. Okay, so right now we're looking at October 11th, and if that changes, I'll notify you accordingly. Members, with that, I think unless the staff have anything to add, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting, and thank you very much for attending.